reverence for all of life, or was Albert Schweitzer nuts? I'll open with two prayers. The first one I gave last night. It's the one I always teach little children whenever I give a children's sermon at church, and whether I bring my wife's dog or something else. And I also teach it to them when I used to take the children out for bird walks and nature walks here during the summer. And that is this one. Blessed thy beasts, O Lord, and singing birds, and guard with tenderness small things that have no words. Amen. And then the other prayer that I'll open with is Prayer for the Animals by Albert Schweitzer. Hear our humble prayer, O God, for our friends, the animals, especially for animals who are suffering, for animals that are overworked, underfed, and cruelly treated, for all wistful creatures in captivity that beat their wings against bars, for any that are hunted or lost or deserted or frightened or hungry, for all that must be put to death. We entreat them all thy mercy and pity, and for those who deal with them, we ask a heart of compassion and gentle hands and kindly words. Make us ourselves to be true friends to animals, and so to share the blessings of the merciful. Amen. Now, I was going to discuss today how to throw a party, but I'm putting that off until I'll be here the last 2 weeks of June. I'm scheduled for the last 2 weeks of June in our 25th anniversary celebration here. And the take-home story on it is this, in just a few words. Jesus had very good instructions on how to throw a party, but none of us want to hear it, because you don't invite somebody who's going to pay you back. You invite those that can't pay you back. The take-home lesson, and I try to tell everybody this and try to practice it myself, you always have a project going in which you're trying to help somebody that not in your wildest dreams could you ever figure out how they could ever repay you. And it's a good discipline. So that's all you're going to get on how to throw a party. That takes care of that one. The other one is more challenging, and it's really, in a way, an autobiography of the development of my thinking regarding reverence for life, for all of life. And I'm doing it now because September 4th is the day people usually pick to honor certainly one of the great men of this century. I became interested in Albert Schweitzer in the late 40s. And I was very disappointed when Time magazine, you know, they were going to have the man of the half century as a cover on their on Time magazine in 1950. And I was voting for Albert Schweitzer. Winston Churchill got him. But who, incidentally, I just learned this week, for those of you who heard my pig lecture, his wife always called him pig. And when he wrote to his wife, he'd draw a picture of a pig. Sign his name. Thought that's something you needed to know. And we celebrate today, or this month, really September 4th, we're just a few days late, but time doesn't make that much difference up here, but it's still September, and I don't know why they always celebrate his death, which was September 4th, 1965. He was 90 years old then, and he was born January 14th, 1865, but they always celebrate on September 4th. It was announced today, this is the 90th anniversary of his decision at the age of 21 to give his life, what he called for humanity. At that point in his life, he felt that his blessings, physical stamina, mental gifts, a secure home with understanding parents, placed an obligation upon him. On the other hand, he felt he could not shut out those less fortunate than himself, and he believed he shared in the Western guilt for enslaving and exploiting Africans. And so he, at age of 21, decided that, made this decision 90 years ago, that when he got to be 30, that's what he'd do. And weaving in my presentation today will be some of his life. My thinking on this subject and my views on it have been profoundly affected by several writers. Certainly Albert Schweitzer ranks very high in this and has meant a very great deal to my development of this. My readings in the Old and New Testament, with some of which we'll review, and some of you will be reading some of these in a little while. Certainly the post-biblical rabbinical writings have affected, had an impact on me, as well as Russian novelists such as Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn. And I mentioned Albert Schweitzer in a book that I give to a lot of people by a friend of mine named Anne Cottrell Free. She did Animals, Nature, and Albert Schweitzer, and mainly from pointing out his concern for animals, because she's very much into animals. She also did the anniversary thing. She was a correspondent in Washington for many years. In young days, during the Roosevelt administration, she was assigned to follow around Eleanor Roosevelt. And when they had an anniversary not long ago, she led that. She's a very interesting person. And she wrote this book, and then now and then meet her and talk to her, and it's this has been a very helpful book. I also owe a great debt to C.S. Lewis, who along with many others feel, as I do, that there'll be animals in heaven. And Helmut Thielicke, who I'll quote from before I finish today, Jacques Ellul, and a person who has become my friend, Paul Tournier, who told me when I saw him last, which was just 2 years ago, his last fall, he was 85 then, and he came into town, drove into town to have dinner with me in Geneva. And he had 5 lectures that week, and he also told me he was going to get another dog when he got old. He has a great sense of humor. I started a course in Reverence for Life in the late 70s at Washington State University. And mainly women veterinary students came to it. And it wasn't because I'm a handsome young man, but they have more compassion than men. And I restrict usually the number that attend the class. I involved some theologians in it because I've been very concerned about many theologians over quite a period of time because of their strong anthropocentrism, their failure to take a holistic view. And I've got a few born-again theologians now who are writing about animals. They're born-again animal people. Roger Penninger would usually come in and give the Schweitzer, because he's a Schweitzerian. He's been here at Holden Village. He's a student pastor at Washington State University. And Jim Rimbach, a very interesting fellow, he was a Missouri Synod pastor. His PhD is from Johns Hopkins. And he's a very good Hebrew scholar. And I got him all psyched up on this and brought him in. And he... In fact, I said, he made such a scholarly presentation, I said, you ought to publish it. And in fact, it was published in International Journal of Study of Animal Problems. And let me read you, I'll be extracting some of this is from his presentation. And since that time, in the last issue of the Journal of the Delta Society, he has another article. He's in a He's presently in a teaching seminary in Hong Kong. He was recently back here in the West visiting. So that's the people who have affected me remarkably. I believe that it's well that we address this subject of reverence for life at this time in history, when in my generation we have become immune to catastrophic dimension. Killing, even mass genocide, doesn't seem to shake us anymore. No civilization has been as wasteful of time and life as ours has. We must take killing more seriously. Our animals and people must no longer be regarded as disposable items, as throwaway items. And they really are. I carry something in my book here, and I'm teaching this now at Washington State. And I usually open with this because I was a witness to some rather terrible things. And holocausts is one of the subjects I discuss, and you notice it's plural, because they continue. They're continuing right now. But this is by an educator. My eyes saw what no person should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers. Children poisoned by educated physicians. Infants killed by trained nurses. Women and babies shot by high school and college graduates. Some of them threw the babies in the air and shot them. So I'm suspicious of education. My request is help your students to be human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, and educated Eichmanns. In my childhood, I was brought up to be kind people, especially handicapped people. In fact, we had what was called a feeble-minded boy in our neighborhood. And my parents, my mother especially, said she assigned me to go and play with Erling quite frequently and to invite him also to our home and to look after Erling. When people picked on Erling, I was to help defend him, it not at some cost. And also to take care of domestic animals on the farm. But wildlife, including birds and plant life, were not included. They were fair game. Fair game. When I became big enough to throw a rock, you'd throw it at creepy crawly things and pookie birds. And then you graduated from a rock to a slingshot, and then to a BB gun, then to a 22 short, then a 22 special, and then to a shotgun. We had first a 28 gauge, and then we got 12 gauge, and then a rifle. That was the progression. And anything that moved that was not domestic livestock was an appropriate target. So we had a lot of target practice. I had developed a careless disregard for many lovely creatures, in great part due to peer pressure. Now, this was a problem early in Schweitzer's life. He was an unusually sensitive child, far more sensitive than I, and probably most of you. He was a son of a Lutheran pastor in Alsace. And when he was about 8 years old, the neighbor boy, who was nine, and one spring morning, early spring morning, said, tomorrow let's go out with our slingshots and shoot birds. It was Sunday morning. It was a lovely morning like today, really, kind of cool. And they went out to the edge of town. And they found a tree that still, the leaves weren't on the tree yet. And there was a lot of birds singing in it. The neighbor boy, like an Indian, reached down and picked up a rock and put in his slingshot, signaled Albert to do the same thing, which he did, kind of shaking while he did it. And then they both, and he vowed that, well, if he shoots, I'll shoot. And so they pulled back their slingshots. And just as Albert pulled back his slingshot, just before he released it, the warning bell for the early church services rang in the village. And he threw down his slingshot on the rock and ran for home. Thereby, of course, scaring away the birds. And in recalling this event, Albert Schweitzer stated, "And ever afterwards, when the bells of Holy Week ring out amidst the leafless trees in the sunshine, I remember with moving gratitude how they rang into my heart at that time, the commandment, thou shalt not kill." Years later, reflecting on this incident, he realized that that particular day marked a turning point in his life. From that day on, he had the courage to free himself from the fear of men. In this regard, he wrote, "There slowly arose in me the unshakable conviction that we had the right to bring pain and death to another being only in the case of inescapable necessity, and that all of us must feel the horror that lies in thoughtless torturing and killing. This conviction has become increasingly dominant within me," he wrote on. "I have become more and more certain that at the bottom of our hearts we all think so and simply do not dare to admit it and practice it, because we are afraid that others will laugh at us for being sentimental and because we have allowed our better feelings to be blunted. But I vowed that I would never let my feelings get blunted, and I would never again fear the reproach of sentimentalism. Whoever," he said, "is spared personal pain must feel himself called upon to help in diminishing the pain of others. We must carry our share of the misery which lies upon the world." While still a student, he wrote, "I resolved to devote my life until I was 30 to the office of preacher, to science, and to music. If by the time I should have done what I had hoped in science and music, I would take a path of immediate service to my fellow men." And in 1905, when he reached the age of 30, he had already earned 2 doctor's degrees and another degree and certification. He had published 3 books, and he realized at that time the desperate need of the people in the African Congo for medical help. In fact, when he was 29, he read something from the Paris Mission Society. It was the needs of the Congo mission, and he decided at that point that the search was over. "The article I finished, I quietly began my work." And he then enrolled in medical school, and for the next 7 or so years, he developed his skills. He got his degree, his MD degree, and he did this, as he said, so he could help these victims of disease and foreign exploitation, who even then were pressed into forced labor, even slavery. And he examined the philosophies of Indian China. He was disturbed that his own countrymen had disregarded great compassion these people had for animals. And that's true. As my friend Fred Smith, of course, who's a historian, can tell you, long before Western Europe or anyone else became concerned about a holistic view on animals, especially Indian and China, they were well advanced in taking care of the needs of animals and showing great compassion. And he read these, and then he saw in his own community how the people would run their horses, sometimes overloaded them, often limping, and this really really got to him. And his thoughts are reflected and extended in the following observations. What is the nature of this degeneration in our civilization? Why has it come about? The disastrous feature of our civilization is that it is far more developed materially than spiritually. Its balance is disturbed. Now come the facts to summon us to reflect. They tell us in terrible harsh language that there's civilization which develops only on its material side and not in the sphere of the spirit heads for disaster. And when he got to Africa, he lived in a continual state of mental turmoil, really. He was trying to figure out the real nature of affirmative attitude and ethics, and the question of what they had in common. He went on to say that he was wandering about in a thicket in which no path was to be found, and was leaning with all his might against an iron door that would not yield. And the answer finally came suddenly and unexpectedly on a September day in 1915, while on a slow-moving barge inching up the Ogowe River on a mission of mercy, because he often was called as soon as they found out about him. They would call him for these missions of mercy, but they didn't have helicopters. I mean, you get on a slow boat. And that's what he was doing. And he recalls this. Late on the third day, at the very moment when at sunset we were making our way through a herd of hippopotamuses, or is it hippopotami, it flashed upon my mind, unforeseen and unsought, the phrase, reverence for life. Because he was looking for this, you see. And the search, he said, was over. The iron door yielded, the path in the thicket had become visible. After that, Albert Schweitzer was never the same again. He said, the deeper we look into nature, he wrote, the more we realize that it is full of life. The more profoundly we know that all life is a secret, and that we are united with all life that is in nature. Man can no longer live for himself alone. We must realize that all life is valuable, and that we are united to all of life. From this knowledge comes our spiritual relationship with the universe. And it was, without malice aforethought, that the other night when I gave you my talk on the human-animal bond and pet facilitated therapy, that I opened up with a bonding between Wayne Williams, a zookeeper at Woodland Park Zoo, when he was having his lunch with his pet hippopotamus. And that you recall, those of you there, the hippopotamus was still a young hippopotamus. He had the zookeeper, Wayne, had his lunch bucket here. He'd been in for lunch. And the hippopotamus laying here with his head on his lap. It must have been very heavy. Sleeping away, I mean, very contented. So it has more than meets the eye. I'll read you a few other things about him and tell you just sort of what this is, how this has affected me. And hope also you. He says, through reverence for life, I raise my existence to its highest value and offer it to the world. From the mysticism of reverence for life spring, he drives to create and preserve the values which serve the perfection of man and mankind, and the sum of which constitutes culture. His behavior makes man affirm life and the world, and also makes him ethical. He was chauvinistic, typical of that time. It is the experience of a responsibility. And ethics to him, and it's a definition I often use, is responsibility with regard to everything that has life. He, the humane person, he says, feels the happiness in helping living things and shielding them from suffering and annihilation. He said of the humane person, it is their duty to ponder in every separate case whether it is really and truly necessary thus to sacrifice an animal for humanity. They ought to be filled with the anxious care to alleviate as much as possible the pain which they cause. And a person is ethical only when life as such is sacred to him, that of plants and animals as that of his fellow man, and when he devotes himself helpfully to all life that is in need of help. Now, what it has meant for me is that, for example, when I go out walking here in one of my favorite places, and I always make a trip to Miner's Village every fall, and it's kind of melancholy in a way because the birds have mostly all gone, and I'm a birder. But I sit there and think about this and what lies before. But as I walk through there, even now there are flowers there. And earlier there are paintbrushes and butter and eggs and other things. And I don't go walking through these. I watch where I step. And because why kill these things? They're very beautiful. In fact, Albert Schweitzer himself, He didn't like it when you brought him cut flowers. Leave them growing. People would always bring him a bouquet of flowers when he came to America. I mean, he thanked them for their thoughts, but he'd rather had them, left them where they were. So I ask you to consider this. And I used to, I'm very fond of the seashore, because I was born and raised near the seashore. And I'm still very fond of that. And I used to go on the seashore, and I'd pick up rocks and throw them. As I thought about it, you know, when you pick up one of those rocks, there's usually some crabs and a lot of creepy crawly things under there, you know? So I disturbed their home, and as I threw the rock, I probably hit another home and messed that up too, you know? I didn't take care of one, I probably took care of two or three of them. Why, you know? Does it really make sense? And to me, it really doesn't make sense. So I quit throwing rocks, picking things up. I do take oysters, though. I make certain compromises. Now, I'm going to shift to another very troublesome subject, because many people on the contemporary scene blame most of the ecological ills of the world on the Judeo-Christian teaching. Well, I should also say that Schweitzer and a lot of people, you know, a lot of people think he is nuts and was nuts. I mean, because he wouldn't kill anything that he didn't really have to. And as he'd walk along the path, like see a bunch of ants going across, he'd step over the ants, or a worm crawled out. Or within the sun where they might, and he'd take the worm and put it back. When he extended the hospital and they'd build the foundation and everything, he was very careful, I mean, to say, now, don't mess up a lot of creatures here. I don't want the foundation of this hospital to be built on the carcasses of a lot of animals. and so he would be very careful about that, and when they dug, made the excavations, he'd go there and check before they went any further to see if some toads or something had fallen in there, which he would then rescue before they went on with it. I mean, and I find myself, I quit stepping on all these bugs and stuff, and especially ladybugs. I always take them outside, unless it's too cold, then I put them in the greenhouse. So that's where he's coming from. But in going back to this, the Judeo-Christian ethic has been blamed for a lot of the ecological ills. And they cite principally in Genesis that man is to exercise dominion over nature with these words. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. Fill the earth and subdue it. And that, to many people, think, you know, I can do anything I damn well please. Because those animals and the plants are there only to serve me. And I can do anything I want with them. And if you read the rest of Scripture and rabbinical writings, you'll know that if you feel that way, you are wrong. And I was very interested in Michael Fox, who also did a lot of blaming for the Judeo-Christian ethic about this, and he's a longtime friend of mine, Michael Fox is, and he published this journal, and I wrote to him and told him that he ought to read this article and consider publishing it, this one by Rimbach, and he did, and he wrote an editorial to it, which I'm going to read you. Called the slippery semantics of the word dominion. The word dominion, which is interpreted by many as equivalent to domination, is defined primarily in Webster's dictionaries indicating sovereignty. Roget's International Thesaurus interprets dominion as realm, domain, or jurisdiction, and therefore makes dominion, domination, sovereignty, and supremacy synonymous. Thus, the passages in Genesis 1:26 that proclaims that man has dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth can be interpreted as meaning that he's been granted sovereignty, jurisdiction, or domination. The passage does not state, however, to what degree humans as dominionists or sovereigns may exploit the rest of creation. No ethical limits are set. Thus, the term dominion is ambiguous insofar as it does not denote to what degree humans as dominionists or sovereigns may exploit the rest of creation, but in other parts of the Bible there are very clear injunctions to dress and to keep the earth, to treat animals humanely, and to rest beasts of burden on the Sabbath. What other religion gives the animals a day off? Therefore, while there is ambiguity in the use of the word dominion in the context of Genesis passage, interpretation of dominion as domination or license to exploit animals for whatever purpose becomes impossible when the passage is placed beside the many injunctions in the Bible that advise us to treat animals with kindness. The idea of domination can be seen as heretically and hubristically self-serving. In this edition of the journal, J. Rumbach reviews Old Testament and post-biblical Jewish literature, which reveals clearly that the teaching of reverence for life is an integral part of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Furthermore, evidence is clearly presented to show that any narrow interpretation of the word dominion as meaning domination is both incorrect and contrary to the essence of Judeo-Christian tradition. And he wasn't of that mind before he read that, of what Rimbach wrote. Now, we are representatives of a cosmic Lord as steward, as caretakers of a great creation. But exercising dominion is a heavy burden with opportunities for great good and horrendous evil. In Genesis, we are told regarding animals, into your hand they are delivered. We, you and I, are explicitly responsible. We and our animals share utter dependence upon God. While the animals are not self-conscious of the source of their life, at least that's what people thought, God's intention for them is in large part mediated by the likes of you and me. In this regard, we share responsibility with the divine. The recognition that our animals are not self-conscious of the source of their gift of life places an added responsibility on us all. There is throughout the Old Testament the added dimension that we and our animals share the same fate, but it is not open to manipulation by the animals, but by us. We are the ones who shape the destiny for the animals and our environment. And my friend Jim Rimbach said, what people do about their ecology depends upon what they think about themselves in relation to the things around them. Human ecology is deeply conditioned by beliefs about our nature and destiny, that is, by religion. St. Thomas Aquinas wrote in Summa Theologica, God's purpose in creation was the communication of his own goodness, in which his creatures participate by reason of their existence and in the measure of it. Only by the most heavy-handed and insensitive treatment can the Bible and other relevant material be used to support the view that the natural world is at our disposal. What place and what value the animals and the rest of the created order have is bound up in the question, what value do we have and why? Stantmeyer wrote, nothing comparable to modern exploitation of nature was known in biblical times. Exploitation and compulsive manipulation were simply not possible on so vast a scale in pre-industrial, pre-technocratic societies. The ecological ills, which are sometimes blamed on Judeo-Christian influence, especially the command, have dominion and subdue it, are not at all necessary outgrowth of that statement. Certainly Israelite tradition did not evidence them. Now, this is sort of reiterating what Fox really extracted from this. In fact, a case can be made quite to the contrary, and I'd like to take this opportunity to set the record straight on this matter from my vantage point. And this is now Rimbach speaking, and to some extent me. A frequent theme is the so-called wisdom literature of the Old Testament and in the fables of the ancient East, and that much we have much to learn by watching and imitating animals, such as in Proverbs, go to the ant, thou sluggard. Or to learn industriousness and foresight. The animals also may serve as models in their seeming lack of anxiety and their carefree enjoyment of times. And what Rimbach has recently done which was recently published in our journal, Be Kind to the Teacher was the title of it. And it's a survey of ancient wisdom drawn from animal fables and related material. A very fascinating article. A frequent theme in the so-called... Here's another one. The animals also serve as models in their seeming lack of anxiety and their carefree enjoyment of good times. See, the birds aren't worrying about tomorrow so much, you know. They're living today and enjoying it. And one of the attractions of animals, especially dogs and cats, they're forever juvenile. They're forever juvenile. Even my wife's dog, Great Reluctance, when he was 15, still loved to play. Just like a... And her present dog, who I call Dingbat, but I don't want you to call her Dingbat. Her name is Bridget. She's soon 9, and she just plays like a pup. But the one I like, because I've been on a farm, and those of you who are farmers, you know, when you raise the calves in the pen there, and you've fed them, nursed them along, and then the spring day comes, and you open the door and let them out. You shall go forth leaping like calves from the stall. I mean, they really turn it on. The trouble is, they don't even see fences. They might go right through them. I mean, they don't care about nothing. They're just out there having fun. Or this from Matthew's Gospel. Consider the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. And there are reference to parenting, a frequent phrase in the Psalms. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Or in the protective attitude of the hen gathers her chicks. Find expression in the New Testament. Jesus used these in many of his discussions. And then we have the injunction of the Israelites to show kindness. And now, I hope some of you have looked up these phrases in the Bible, because I'm going to call on you momentarily. Not to seize the young in the wild bird's nest. Deuteronomy 22:6. Will somebody read that? And somebody else get Exodus 23. See the assignments up here? Deuteronomy 25:4. Now, I wrote them big enough so you can see them up there. If you can read my writing. So we're going through those now, because these are very critical to the argument. Somebody on Deuteronomy 22:6. Right. Exodus 23:10.
For 6 years, plant your land and gather in what it produces. But in the 7th year, let it rest, and do not harvest anything that grows on it. The poor may eat what grows there, and the wild animals can have what is left. Right. Do the same with your vineyards and your olive trees.
Well, a whole year of it. Deuteronomy 25:4.
You shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain.
That's right. It's got a right to some of it. And then this very critical one from Proverbs. A righteous man has regard for the life of his beast.
Mm-hmm. Where is that?
In Proverbs. Yeah. And in post, we're going to get to the other two in a minute. In post-biblical literature, the rabbis, it's marked by numerous legislations designed to ensure a degree of kindness towards animals and to prevent them from being mistreated. And I've talked to a lot of Jewish people, and they're always surprised when I tell them what some of their early rabbinical teachings are. Cruelty to anything possessed of life was considered a crime. It was recognized that animal slaughter was necessary for society, but very elaborate precautions were taken to minimize the pain involved. By the time of the Middle Ages, there were a list of 70 proscriptions, which constituted unskillful and therefore unacceptable slaughter. Investigators have consistently remarked that Jews were not known to kill animals for sport. Typical of the attitude of rabbis is this prescription in Gittin. A man is forbidden to eat anything until he has fed his beast. In fact, the only interruption to Jewish grace at a meal in early days was if you hadn't fed your beast. Rabbinical literature is full of stories that center on well-known biblical figures. A few references will illustrate the attitudes of this tradition. If men make a sea voyage and take cattle with them, should a storm arise, they jettison the animals to save mankind because people do not love animals as much as they love human beings. Not so is God's love. Just as he is merciful to man, so he is merciful to beast. And this from Rabbinical Anthology. The falling of rain is greater than the giving of the law. For the giving of the law was a joy only to Israel, while the falling of rain is a rejoicing for all the world, including the cattle and the wild beasts and the birds. While Moses was feeding the sheep of his father-in-law in the wilderness, a young kid ran away. Moses followed it until it reached a ravine where it found a well to drink from. And when Moses reached it, he said, "I did not know that you ran away because you were thirsty. Now you must be weary." He carried the kid back. Then God said, "Because thou hast shown pity in leading back one of a flock belonging to a man, thou shalt lead my flock Israel." And there's evidence, in fact, that both the selection of Moses for leadership as well as David, significant to their selection, was their concern for animals. In the biblical book of Jonah, the prophet wanted God to destroy the inhabitants of Nineveh, which was countered, you tell us, in Jonah 4:11. Somebody have that?
"How much more then should I have pity on Nineveh, that great city? After all, it has more than 120,000 innocent children in it, as well as many animals."
And also much cattle in another interpretation. In other words, he was concerned about both the animals and the people. In my readings as well as in my observations, there is recognition that animals and people enjoy a symbiotic relationship. I mean, certainly that's what Elmer Witt has been hitting you with for the last 3 days. The animals contribute to people's enjoyment of life with their sheer presence, by their labor, and perhaps surprisingly to us today, by the many sounds that they contribute to the environment. And it makes life far more enjoyable. I sometimes used to, in the old days, here at Holden, we'd have what I think the eye-openers, they call them. And that's when we'd meet usually in the village center, and the people would come down there, and you had to jolly them up or at least wake them up. That was part of the assignment. And sometimes I'd ask these walking zombies coming in there at 8 or 8:30, "How many birds did you hear singing on your way down here?" You know, and like, "Birds?" You know. I mean, but had they been listening, they would have heard 10 or 11 birds on the way down from there to here in the summer. But they never even heard him, you see. Read Song of Songs or Song of Solomon 2, 11 and 12. Somebody got Song of Solomon?
For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land.
Now, I got a slide of that with a beautiful scene, and I usually show it in the spring, but sometimes I show it also in the fall. I'd like to go to New Zealand in the fall and show it there. You know. Or this from Isaiah. This is Isaiah 11, 6 to 7. 6 and 7.
"The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and the little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox."
Some wag, some spoil sport says, "The leopard may lie down with the goat, but the goat won't sleep very well." But this idyllic scene is an acknowledgement by the prophet that there is something wrong in the present relationship of predator and prey in the animal kingdom and in human-animal relationship. There is a promise of something infinitely better, as well as a deep yearning for a real change. And here I turn to one of my favorite preachers of the present age. He's a little older than I am. His name is Helmut Tielicke in Hanover. He's written a lot of great books. And he is an outstanding preacher. He says, "Creation becomes like a talent entrusted to us. There is a sort of community with animals, In a healthy world, all created beings are together under God. Humanity stands under God consciously, the animals unconsciously. Of course, we know now that animals have a certain consciousness and an awareness, and I'll address that in June. This talent of consideration given and entrusted to humanity cannot be turned against those who are subordinate and subjected to us. For if we exercise our dominion in the name of God, we can only exercise it in the name of that love which drives us beyond ourselves, in the name of that fostering care which God devotes to all his creation. And then this very touching personal note by Dr. Tielecki regarding his own dog, and I really like this. "My little canine friend, you are just one particular part of creation. The two of us, in contrast to innumerable fellow creatures of yours, have been brought together in a remarkable way and live with one another. If something bad would happen to you, I would be very upset. And I know that if something would happen to me, that your canine heart would be affected. You notice at once if something is bothering me. And if I am happy, then you make the most droll attempts to show me that you rejoice with me. Sometimes the riddle of creation gazes at me from your eyes so powerfully, so terribly, that it penetrates me through and through. I imagine that you suffer under the burden of not being able to express yourself and tell me what you know. Of course, you can be very expressive with your bodily motions and with your tail wagging and even with your little paws. But speaking is just out of the question. Sometimes you let me know that I don't understand you. There is a very deep gulf between us that neither of us can cross. And precisely because you are such a unique part of creation, because you have bound your canine destiny to me, a human being, this limitation becomes particularly painful. Our lives are more fully linked than I can say or you can bark. You are a dumb creature, and maybe you are thinking, my master is a noseless creature." The fundamental picture which emerges from the study of Judeo-Christian tradition is that humankind is not only to respect nature's rights in the passive way, but to act positively to preserve and defend them. Jim Rembach and I and many others believe the attitude of superiority and contempt of nature is quite foreign, not only to the biblical world, but to the ancient world in general. We believe it can be shown to have its roots in the 18th and 19th century mechanistic philosophies and the elevation of technology above the ideal of service to mankind, to humankind, and also to their animals. What is needed is a humane reassessment done in reverence and humility, acknowledging the willing independence we can exercise in regard to our environment and the great benefits that it can accrue therefrom. The call I make is for compassion. And I was so appreciative that Elmer brought up last night the Master Eckhart, who I've heard a lot about, and I haven't read. I just read of him when I read Matthew Fox, and he's had a great impact on him. I think Master Eckhart was in 13th century, I guess. But what he said about compassion. Compassion clothes the soul with the robe of God and divinely adorns it. And those who follow compassion find life for themselves, justice for their neighbor, and glory for God. Compassion means justice, and compassion is just to the extent that it gives to each person what is his or hers. At the risk of some redundancy, I recall for you what one of my fellow professors wrote just not long before he died. He was a fellow professor in the University of California system when I was there. His name is Eric Hoffer. He, although he's had no formal training in schooling, he was probably one of the best read people in the United States. He also knew how to write a crisp sentence better than almost anybody else. That's why his books are short. The publishers used to complain about it. He told me they complained because they weren't long enough. They sell better if they're thicker. And he says, "Well, that he'd say my book has more ideas than most of them, far bigger." and so he got away with it. But he was a longshoreman philosopher, and they finally appointed him as a research professor at Berkeley. Unheard of thing. And so he spent some time at that. One of the last things he wrote before he died was this: it may well be that the survival of the species will depend on our ability to foster a boundless capacity for compassion. Mm. And Matthew Fox sort of reiterated the same theme. It may be our last great hope. And I believe that. I'm going to close with a story. I'm going to leave this open for some discussion for a little while, and then I'm going to tell you a very one of my favorite stories, a brief one, from Lorne Isley's Unexpected Universe. But now, do you have some comments? Do you want to ask about Albert Schweitzer, who is, incidentally, he's probably one of the most decorated, honored people in this century, but he's also, there's a lot of people really teed off on him for a lot of reasons. Some of them not always legitimate. I mean, on the one hand, they say his organ playing is stodgy and his theology is shallow, and his Indian his discussions of the Indians is something else. But nobody has really fully assessed him because he's so eclectic. He's covered so many fields, you see. He has studied and written in so many fields, and there aren't very many people, I don't know anyone, that can really fully analyze him. See, and that's part of the problem. But I can go into some of the arguments. In fact, there is a very good, I taught at the University of Tennessee this last April, and one of the members of the religion department is David Dungan, and he wrote at the 100th anniversary, back in 75, yes, his 100th anniversary of his birth, in Christian Century, he wrote Reconsidering Albert Schweitzer, and he discusses a lot of these arguments. And makes a fine presentation. And in fact, he was like a voice in the wilderness at a time when nobody was really looking at this holistic view. You know, they said, you know, you go down to his hospital, people from this country go down to the hospital, it's dirty, animals running all over, you know, it's ridiculous. They really teed off on him. But then they started to investigate. They asked the Africans. Well, boy, it was right down their alley. Because if you're sick, and the whole family's involved, you see? The whole family's involved. So in fact, sometimes the one that goes to the hospital isn't the sickest one. Or the one at home probably drove them there sometimes. But you have to look at the whole family as a unit, which included animals in their society. See, they're part of the society. And they had arrangements so that the whole family comes trucking to the hospital. They bring their own food, they can cook it there, and the animals, they are with them. Well, you know, people are resisting that today, but you can go to Rockford, Illinois, the hospital there. What do they have? They have a waiting room now, a special room where the people that are ambulatory can come down there and their pets come in to see them. When the chief was recently in Swedish Hospital, I took her hearing ear dog up to see her. A few years ago in the Swedish Hospital, where they leave nothing to chance, I've been trying to get it changed to the Norwegian Hospital because they do such a good job, but I haven't been able to succeed. But they do a good job there. But I arranged and I don't just go barging in there. I checked with them ahead of time, and I waited till Nancy, the nurse, was on, who loved animals, and of course they can't deny it because a hearing dog, you see, has rights in this state, and assistant dogs do. So I went trucking in there with Bridget, and Bridget was very uncomfortable because this is a new situation, but they laid a blanket on the chief's bed, and the dog is trained not to spend very long time on the bed. You see, it isn't supposed to be on the bed except to go charging up there when the alarm clock goes, or when the smoke alarm goes. It takes an 8-foot leap on top of her, you see, but then gets off. So it was uncomfortable staying on the bed. But Nancy had all these nurses trucking in there to see Bridget and pet her and talk about her and hear about hearing dogs. And so I gave him a lecture. And then they brought the secretaries in. And then one lady down the way, she heard about the dog. She was a patient. She wanted me to come down there because she had a home for retarded children up here at Ferndale. And only two of them could sign. And they just got a little child in, 13, who is legally blind and deaf, but not retarded. She didn't think she was retarded. And she was very lonesome and lonely and turned in on herself and low esteem. And we were discussing what kind of an animal she realized that she should have an animal, you see. So we're seeing now that the animals are coming back into the hospital. And when they reviewed the record of Albert Schweitzer's hospital, as I recall, he had a very good record as far as returning them back to their active life, you see. So it worked. Huh? It worked. Any other?
I have a question.
Yes.
Much of what we know today about treating people for diseases has been acquired through the use of animals for research.
And other people too.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you compromise that?
Yes. Yes. That requires a long answer. We usually take up in my class at least an hour on this subject and more. No, but yeah, I have come to terms with that on the basis that there are certain experiments I would not run. I think there are certain experiments that are vital. But you would do it with the least compromise of the animal, but you relieve the pain and this I'm with Albert Schweitzer. You relieve the pain that you may cause. You use analgesics. You have skilled people doing it and that have respect for the animal. I promote gentling the animal, because if you gentle the animal, you get completely different results than if you don't gentle it. You mess up your whole results. And also I tell people who say, well, you can't do any experiments on animals, you just don't do it. And I say, well, do you take any drugs? Do you take any immunizations? Do you give your dog distemper shots? Well, if you really believe that, you shouldn't, you see, because they were all tested on animals.
Even for Albert Schweitzer and his work, in order to fight infections are caused by the bacteria.
He killed bacteria. Mm-hmm. That's right. And that was always, it's a line you tread, so you make your judgments on that. And this subject of experiments, everybody does experiments. You're doing it all the time, aren't you? If you have a dog, well, does he like gravy train or Hills, regular, or Calcan, or Nine Lives? You run those experiments, or you try different techniques of training. So we're always experimenting. So you have to say, what kind of an experiment? And now we are recognizing this more and more. I'm working hard on having better education of those who do research on animals, and to get compassion into it, and real knowledge. And the other thing is, on the regulation, I've worked at the national level on this, not only with legislation to help animals and permit animals to be in nursing homes, convalescent homes, and this kind of thing, and recognizing assistance dogs, but also, now we have, if you're going to do an experiment at our university or University of Washington or whatever, University of Minnesota, wherever you are, there is a committee, not only of the scientists, but somebody outside the field of science and somebody from outside the university that sit in judgment.
Leo, did you see that documentary, Primate?
No.
It's done by that couple that did high school welfare, Chitticook Follies, all this documentary. You didn't see Tommy?
No, I didn't. Was it good?
I couldn't bear to watch it.
You couldn't, huh?
I want to tell you something one of my sociology professors told us in class in Panadol. He said, if you want to meet really nice people, just go to the supermarket to the pet food counter. And you know it's the truth. Like, you go for bread or anything else and no one talks to you. But the pet food, everybody there just kind of becomes like family. I've met some really nice people.
Especially over the cat food.
It's true.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them there because it's a $3 billion industry.
But why is it that that's become so popular? Because like Albert Schweitzer said, there never was a time in civilization when we were so together, but that we were so alone.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Now we have taken in ants instead of each other.
Yeah. And I mentioned too that... We're going to see more and more animals, and they're in hospices now, and so they're more and more brought into hospitals. And I'm consultant, for example, to the Prince and Prince of Wales Hospice in Glasgow, where we hope at least to be a wing there that you can, when you're terminally ill, you bring your animal with it. For example, my wife, or a guide dog, or Bert, who I told you about, or Angie, if they went to the hospital, their animals should go with them. And there should be provisions for this.